Hi, and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Welcome, if this is your first time, and welcome back if you've been here before. So a few things to cover today. This is episode 81, and apologies to start with. We've had a week's break, or I've had a week's break. I think I explained, hopefully you saw it on some of the social media stuff. Basically had a stinking cold last week. I've still got it a bit now, and my throat was very bad, so I was struggling to talk, much to the elation of my wife. So I'll try and get through this okay, but just bear with me a little bit. I may have to just stop and have a drink as we go through. So that's the first thing. Thanks for buying me a coffee, those that did. Appreciate that. Had some more bought this week. So that was really good, thank you. And downloads again, very good as well. I was slightly worried that because there hadn't been an episode, you know, that's it, no one would download. But actually, it was one of the better weeks I've ever had. So it just shows. And once again, we're recording in the motorhome. We've moved on to Spain now. So some of the sound situations outside are sort of out of my control. But bear with me and hopefully they'll be okay. So we'll get started now. Frustratingly, we're actually going to go back a couple of episodes briefly because there's a couple of stories that I really wanted to tell you. So just back two episodes to the COVID talk that we had about policing COVID and how that worked, certainly in Scotland, in the area that I worked. And there was a couple of things that I wanted to cover, and in fact, had a couple of questions as well. So I wanted to just cover those for you as well. And somebody had raised the point about, I talked about the animosity between the, you know, people visiting, or when I say visiting, when lockdown happened, immediately people that owned second homes in Scotland, quite often from down south and very often London, sort of immediately made their way north of the border to their little hidey hole, you know, their holiday home, thinking that they were going to ride out COVID there, you know, and very quickly the police got hold of that, and basically it was passed down from on high that wasn't allowed. And there was some animosity between, you know, or from the local sort of villagers towards these people. And it was on sort of two fronts. One was the concern that small local sort of village shop had very limited resources, already stretched by just the local people that live there. You can imagine now you get an influx of outsiders, if you like, and that there was some concern that there was going to be that lack of food. But the biggest concern was that Scotland at that time, and certainly I'd say perhaps compared to the rest of the country, wasn't hit quite as bad, and the early days didn't have, you know, so much of a problem as certainly down south and London, for example, which is obviously very, very populated. So there was real concern that people coming up from London were going to bring up the virus, or, you know, a variant of the virus, and spread it, you know, around these small villages. And that possibly did happen a bit. So that was where the animosity came from. And so it was just to cover off that point, really. And then the second one was a story that I actually really wanted to tell you as well from COVID times. And I completely forgot about it. It was only afterwards that I thought, oh, that was one I really wanted to cover. So I'll just touch on it now. In the first week of lockdown, there was definitely a certain amount of shell shock. You know, people were, you know, very concerned and generally played by the rules and didn't sort of push the limits at all, you know, because no one really knew what those rules were to start with. But one couple particularly, a local couple to where I worked, took it upon themselves to spectacularly break every rule they could, and in fact incurred the wrath of not only the police, but very much the local town as well, who a lot of them turned against them and were really unhappy. Because, as I say, the vast majority were playing by the rules. So what they did was, it was literally the first week of lockdown, they decided that they would go off camping. Now, this was a time when obviously everybody was meant to be in their house. But this couple decided not only would they go camping, they'd go off into the middle of nowhere, like a really rural location. The pair of them would get very, very drunk. And they decided that they would, go wading into the sea. They ended up climbing onto a rock that was on the foreshore, you know, at the edge of the sea, and presumably carried on the heavy drinking they were doing, so they're both very drunk. The tide then came in, which cut them off on their rock, and then they phoned the police to basically, you know, say the situation they were in. So you can imagine there were fairly some fairly sort of incredulous local cops, me being one of them as well. And in the end, but this couple didn't know their location. They didn't know where they were, and being very drunk didn't help. So they're on the phone to the police trying to explain kind of where they were and what was happening, and not doing a very good job, basically. The signal was very poor where they were, and it was very, very difficult to track them down. So, you know, a lot of the local cops had their own ideas as to where they thought these two were, and sort of what was being described to them as a location. So went out themselves, and they were, in the end, we had the situation, the ridiculous situation, bearing in mind this is the first week of lockdown, where there was something like five different police cars, so that's 10 officers looking for these two, quite frankly, idiots. And in the end, the Coast Guard put up one of their helicopters as well. And then further to that, the police helicopter joined them as well, because what they said was that the tide was now coming in. Plus, you know, their battery on their phone was at about, you know, 5%. So that was about to die as well. So there was a certain amount of urgency, to say the least, to rescue, you know, these two people from their drunken state and the rock they found themselves on. Eventually, they were located and brought in. And unfortunately, this was right at the beginning, so there was fines, but they were pathetic. You know, I think they worked out something like, I think they were literally like £50 each or something. And I think somebody worked out that the helicopters alone that had been up for them, never mind the, you know, the 10 cops and the police cars, it was something like £20,000 worth of fuel used looking for them, you know, when they should have been at home locked down like everyone else. So they took it to, you know, another level. But, you know, there you go. What can you do? So I just wanted to cover that one. So today we're going to talk about, it's not that an unusual one. And the story is about an out of control teenager. So straight away, most of you are sitting there that have got teenagers and thinking, my teenager's out of control. They're all out of control. You know, I've had teenagers, three of them. And without a doubt, you know, they can be a right pain and very difficult to deal with. And of course, like lots of things, you know, they don't come with a handbook. There is no guidance, and it doesn't matter the background either. You know, some people assume automatically that, oh, you know, a teenager, you know, in a bad area that comes from a council estate, you know, they're the ones that are going to be the problem. Well, in my experience, that's definitely not the case. Yes, of course, that does happen, because, you know, you have those issues all over. But I've been to just as many, you know, sort of out of control teenagers that come from very good backgrounds, you know, private school, a very well off family, you know, a nice house, you know, and all the trappings of wealth. It does not mean that they're not going to be just as out of control as somebody else, you know. And a lot of people assume automatically that there's this one sort of small band of teenagers, you know, that fit into a certain category that are going to be causing the problems, and it's definitely not the case in my experience. But this particular teenager, she was 14, very small build, and that will come into the story later, so bear that one in mind. And the story was, she lived with her mum had split up from her husband, who I think had been very violent within the relationship. Mum had taken to drink herself, and I wouldn't have said she was a full-on alcoholic, but she certainly had a drink problem, and every now and then would go on, you know, a proper bender and really, really get out of control with the drinking. So there was some concerns about her, you know, capacity and capability of actually looking after her daughter. Now, I don't know whether the daughter had perhaps gone off the rails because of, you know, the things she'd experienced within the household from the violent husband, you know, or whether, you know, there could have been various other reasons. But for whatever reasons, we found ourselves getting called to this address time and time again, and not just by the mother, who was desperate for help, but also the neighbours, you know, at the school, the local shops. You know, I mean, this girl was out of control. She was causing absolute mayhem in the town. She was assaulting other kids, you know, younger kids. She was regularly drunk herself. She was shoplifting, you know, she was going missing all the time. And every time that happens, you know, you have to go and take a missing person report. There's loads of paperwork involved and a lot of resources and work gets put into missing people. So, you know, that's a big commitment as well. She was damaging neighbours' cars, out of control on a number of levels. Now, this just didn't happen overnight. This had gone on for probably 6 months. And we kept going back to the same address, as did other colleagues. And, you know, we had neighbours coming in to the police station complaining, you know, why aren't we doing something about it? Well, it's very difficult when someone is young, because you're not in a position that you can start, you know, locking people up at that age for the more minor stuff. Certain stuff you could do, depending on where you are, although in Scotland that's even more difficult because the rules are slightly different up there. Certainly down south in England, teenagers of 14, you know, regularly get arrested. Up in Scotland, very rarely happens because it's a slightly different set of rules, as I say. Not impossible, but it does happen. So it was decided that we would go to this address in conjunction with, and we'd lined this up with social services already, who work very closely with the police in relation to kids. Now, a placement had actually been found for this girl in a children's home in a town that was about a 2-hour drive from where she lived. And she had no idea this was coming, but we'd been instructed, myself and my colleague, to go and get hold of this girl and basically take her. And because it was actually quite away from where we worked, a local police car from that area where the home was, where the kids' home was going to come down and meet us halfway. And we were going to effectively hand her over to them. And then they would take her in conjunction with social services to this kids' home. And she was going to have a period of time in this kids' home while they tried to, you know, figure out what was going on with her behaviour-wise. And also get some help for the mum, you know, because, as I say, there was definitely quite a few issues going on there one way or another. So we went to the address, and to be honest with you, you know, I knew this girl fairly well. And yes, she was kind of, you know, aggressive and mouthy, as most teenagers are. But I didn't expect, you know, too many problems. So we turned up. Mum was drunk, if I remember right. She also knew what was coming and that the child was to be taken away. And I say child because in the eyes of the law, she is a child. But as we all know, you know, sort of 14, 15, 16-year-olds, male and females, that physically appear, you know, just like adults. But ultimately, as I say, that they are you know, children in the eyes of the law. So we went to the address and spoke to Mum. As I say, she'd had a good few drinks, explained to her what was going to happen, and she pretty much knew what was coming. And she said, well, she's upstairs in bed. She's refusing to get up. She's under the covers, and she basically won't speak to me or anyone else. But she confirmed that she was dressed. So we go up, and we tried to play it nicely and hoped that it would all go fairly well. Knocked on the door. No answer. So eventually we opened the door because we knew she was in there. And this again, you know, shows obviously the child element of it. She kind of threw the duvet over her head and stayed under the covers, you know, and refused to speak to us. So it was very much, you know, kid stuff, quite frankly. But I knew the effect she'd been having on the town. And as I say, the neighbours and her mum, you know, so this is a very unpleasant task for sure. But in this case, I actually thought it was definitely warranted because something had to happen. You know, this could not carry on how it had been. So we spoke to her for some time. I mean, it was something like half an hour, maybe even an hour, to try and convince her that, you know, look, we explained what was happening and where she was going. She wasn't very happy, as you can imagine. She wasn't upset. She was more angry. And I mean, probably internally, I suspect she was upset. But externally, you know, she showed it as anger and shouted and swore at us, you know, and said that we weren't taking her anywhere and she wasn't coming with us, etc. So we tried to, you know, speak reasonably with her for, say, some time. It just wasn't getting anywhere. And ultimately, we had to give her an ultimatum and said, look, you are coming, you know, and there's two ways we can do it. You just walk out like an adult with us and we'll go and get this sorted. You know, this is going to happen. You're not going to stop it. Alternatively, you know, it's going to get physical. We're going to have to lay hands on you because there was no other choice. And, you know, don't get me wrong. I take absolutely no pleasure in putting hands on, you know, children and physically having to restrain them. But there, unfortunately, there is a time for it. And this is what turned out in the end to happen. So we'd not begged her, but we really had negotiated for a long time and it was getting ridiculous. And my female colleague who I was with went over and pulled the covers back basically and got hold of her arm and started to sit the girl up. You know, it wasn't like we went over and put her in a full on, you know, headlock and started dragging her down the stairs by her hair or anything. Literally just took hold of her arm and stood her up and started to walk her out towards the stairs. At which point she did a classic, which was basically become a dead weight. And I was carrying, well, I had one of her arms. My colleague sort of loosely had her hand, I think, around her arm as well, the other arm. And she basically just went a dead weight and dropped her weight. So she pulled me down and gave me a sort of sharp jolt to the back. And she dropped to the top of the banisters, you know, at the top of the stairs, and just clung on for dear life and refused to be taken off. And by now, this is a full-on, you know, kind of screaming banshee. She's spitting and shouting and, you know, kicking out. She managed to kick my colleague, I think, twice in the leg. And in the end, we had to basically kind of peel her hands off of the banister. And this is exactly what we didn't want. And this is why we'd taken an hour to negotiate with her and stop this happening. But unfortunately, that's exactly what did happen. And eventually, we basically put her in handcuffs. Again, not something you really want to do, but she has to come out of that house. And it's the only way it's going to happen. Now, we needed to get her down the stairs, and the stairs were very narrow. It wasn't like two of us could kind of get side by side and carry her down the stairs. Now, I've already mentioned her age at 14, and physically she was very, very small. I can't give you an exact height, but probably, you know, like 5'2", 5'3", tall, something like that, and very, very light, skinny, you know, nothing of her at all. So I thought, I'll just pick her up and carry her down the stairs. So I basically put my arm around her kind of waist, picked her up, carried her in front of me, and I just walked down the stairs with her. And it seemed to work reasonably well. Ultimately, we got her out into the car or into the van. We had a prison van with us, and she was put into the van. So out she went into the van, and then we were looking at driving off on this handover, which is exactly what we did. And that was all very straightforward. You know, we handed her over to our colleagues. By now, she'd calmed down a bit. The handcuffs had come off fairly early on once we'd actually got her out of the address. And we headed back to the Nick. It was basically time for a bite to eat and a coffee. So we headed back. And just prior to having something to eat, I'd nipped to the toilet. So I went in, I'd been to the loo, and I went to wash my hands, and I turned the taps on and I bent forward slightly at the waist, as you do to put your hands in the sink to wash them. And as I did that, there was this absolutely horrendous shooting pain that ran up sort of the backs of my thighs and into my lower back. I've never ever felt pain like it. It was absolute agony. And it literally made me shout out, you know, and stand up. And I had no idea what was happening. You know, I'd never had anything like this happen in the past, or thankfully since. And I basically walked out into the hallway, and I was sort of shouting out for my colleague who had just gone down into the sort of report writing room, and she come running back out into the you know, the corridor to see what was happening. And I could barely stand. I was really struggling to stand. And I remember I had both my hands, the flat of my hands, on the wall in the corridor, trying to sort of support myself and actually sort of keep upright. And I would imagine I was fairly high pitched at that point myself, and was virtually, you know, shouting out in agony. And my colleague was going, "Oh my God, you know, what's happened? You know, what's the matter?" You know, and I said, I've no idea. You know, my back's just gone. Considerably higher pitch than that, how I've just explained it to you. And she said, I just don't know what to do. You know, you're in such a state. And she said, I think we'll have to take you to the hospital. Luckily, the hospital is very, very close. Now, this is the point that every time I went into the hospital, invariably, I would have a good bit of banter with the doctors and the nurses there. My wife worked in the same place and I knew a lot of them fairly well. So I was forever winding them up. So I knew that when I turned up with my, you know, hurty back, I probably wasn't going to be taken too seriously. And sure enough, I did get a fair bit of stick from the nurses in there about, you know, basically what a big baby I was, you know. But thankfully saw the doctor and he said quite calmly, you know, he assessed me and said, oh yeah, it's a back spasm, you know, it's a muscle spasm. And I said, you know, is it serious? You know, because it feels like absolutely horrendous at the moment, you know, that I'm never going to walk again. And he was like, oh, no, it will fix itself, but it'll take a while. And I was said, when you say a while, you know, what are we talking? Am I going to be back to work, you know, kind of tomorrow or the next day? And he kind of looked at me and was like, absolutely not. He said, you know, you could be off for months. I've known these take 6 months. And I was like, 6 months? I couldn't believe it. You know, this was ridiculous. And I was explaining to him what I'd done, what had happened, you know, that I carried this very light girl down the stairs. But also, if you remember back to the previous episode, it was only a few days before that I'd had this big roll around fight with our nasty scaffolder. And he was saying that chances are you'd done it during that, and it had been hanging on by a thread, and you carrying the girl down the stairs is what kind of, you know, really tipped it off. So needless to say, anyway, I was sent home and I was signed off work for, I think it was like a month or something initially. But it actually ended up being one of the worst injuries, you know, or the worst injury I've had in the job. And I touch wood there, and I also thank myself because I know a lot of people, you know, a lot of my colleagues have had terrible injuries, you know, and worse. So I got away very lightly, really. And that night, I took the painkillers that the doctor had given me. I'm not entirely sure what they were, but he said, you know, have you had these before? They're very strong. Take it easy with these, but have one of these tonight. It'll help you sleep. Well, I say, I don't know what this thing was, but I took it. It was basically like falling back into a warm bath, and I was completely out of it for the night. The only thing that did happen, which was rather strange and I think mildly amusing, I think you'll like, is I was definitely seeing things, all sorts of weird and wonderful visions, and some very strange things happened. Now, I had access to my phone overnight because it was beside me in the bed, like a lot of us have, you know, on the sort of bedside cabinet. And overnight, in my very drugged state, I had some weird idea for some sort of strange water catchment, rain catching device that involved funnels and pipes and things. I'd actually been on eBay and in real life had ordered this stuff with my phone because in my drug-induced state, I was convinced that this was the best idea ever. And when I woke up in the morning, my wife said to me, you know, how did you sleep? And I said, well, it was fantastic taking that pill, whatever that was. You know, and I came up with this great idea and I explained it to her and told her what I'd done and then looked at eBay and found out just how much I'd spent. Needless to say, she confiscated my phone off me and I wasn't allowed to take the tablets kind of unsupervised again. But they were fantastic tablets. So it was a little bit different. But so that was certainly the worst injury that I ever had in the job. And I ended up being off for... it was 2 months in the end altogether. Excuse me. So I'm just going to touch now on a police protection orders as well. That is a power, because somebody asked this on YouTube this week. It's a power that the police have where you can take children into police protective custody. Now, in the incident we described earlier with the girl, that actually wasn't what happened because it was pre-arranged and it was done through social services. So they were kind of ready for her. The police protection order is more for the scenario when you go to an address and you see children that you're so worried about that they're going to come to serious harm, that they're being mistreated or maybe they've been assaulted or perhaps, you know, they're terribly skinny or you're really sure that they're in, you know, very, very serious danger. You can actually take those children out of that situation, and you have a power to, it sounds wrong, but you're to seize the children and take them into your care for 72 hours. Now, there's various scenarios when this can be used. And if you go back to, I think it was episode 43, when I talked about a couple of child neglect cases, that's when I've used it in the past. And the other time that I've used it, which was very, you know, real nasty situation, and unfortunately one that does happen from time to time, is I worked in a town on the south coast of the UK, and we had one of our local drug users, female heavy drug user, and she was regularly getting pregnant, I mean, like all the time, and she'd already had quite a few children, I think something like 8 children in total, but they'd all been taken off her and put into care at various times. Now, people might think that that's very harsh and terrible and it should never happen, but this woman literally couldn't look after herself at all. Her life was heavy class A drugs. That's all she cared about. And certainly in one scenario, she'd been caught negotiating to sell a baby, one of her babies, to somebody for drugs. And in another scenario, she was actually approaching people that she knew that were basically paedophiles, and was attempting again to sell access to her children to these paedophiles. So she was completely out of control. You know, when people are gripped by the heavy class A drugs, you know, they will sell their own mother for that hit of drugs. That's how important it is. And on 3 occasions, I had to go to the hospital when she was pregnant. And when she gave birth, I was there with the social services, and we took that baby the second it was born into, you know, into protective custody under a police protection order. And then basically social services take over. And that's horrendous. And people, again, may be sitting there shocked that that happens, but that is quite a regular occurrence, unfortunately, that mothers that clearly have terrible issues and are not capable of looking after children, and we know that before they've had the children, then unfortunately cops will be there at the birth, and the second the child is born, it's taken off them and then handed to police and then social workers and away. And that is a really, really unpleasant task for sure, because obviously it's something that should be, you know, a very happy time. But unfortunately, when you're in the police, you don't necessarily get to pick and choose your jobs, and you know, a lot of the roles that you have and the tasks you have to carry out within the police are pretty unpleasant, but that's got to be right up there as one of the worst for sure. So that'll do us for this week. I think we've covered a few things, certainly a few tangents and a bit of rambling, as somebody said during the week as well. We also have a fair bit of rambling on Police Stories Podcast. Thanks very much for listening. And we'll talk again next week. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye.